What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Frank, thank you very much. Welcome to The Exchange. I'm Tyler Matheson, in for Kelly Evans. Here's what's ahead. Not a bubble, but bubbly. That's how one of our guests describes today's market. But that doesn't mean you can't still find some bargains. He's looking for them. We'll tell you where. Plus, shares of Tesla down more than 30% this year so far. Should you buy the dip or steer clear as the EV winter continues? And Elizabeth Warren once again goes after the company. And it's been a big week for the builder stocks, but our analyst brings a surprise name not in that sector that he calls a stealth housing play. He joins us ahead. We got a mystery chart, but we begin with today's markets and Dom Chu with the numbers. Hey, Dom.
All right, it's a little bit mixed, but modestly so after coming off record days for all the indices earlier this week, especially just yesterday in that big surge that we saw in the markets. The Dow Industrial is currently down about 182 points. That's off 0.5%, relatively flat for the S&P 500. It's currently sitting at 5238, down about 3 points. At the highs of the session, we were only up about 3 points, maybe down 12 points at the low. So again, a pullback from those record high levels, but again, modestly so at this point. The NASDAQ Composite, the tech heavier index, 16,435, outperforming, up 33 points. That's up about 0.25%. The reason why we want to highlight that NASDAQ trade is because it has been the stellar one. All three of the major indices on a one-week basis are up roughly 2.25 to nearly 2.75% overall. The sectors that are leading the way higher are communication services and technology, so that kind of magnificent seven trade, alongside industrials, all up between 2.5% and 3.5%. Meanwhile, the underperformer has been on the interest rate sensitive side, XLRE, the real estate side of things, down about 1% over the last week. That's your state of play on this Friday. But the stock that a lot of focus has been on has been kind of a tale of two different types of narratives in just the last week. For Apple shares, we started the week off on a fairly positive note with some of that news reports, especially from Bloomberg, that said that it could be possibly teaming up with Alphabet's Google to offer Gemini AI, the Alphabet side of things, the AI platform, on future iPhones. That gave a boost. And then all of a sudden, the Department of Justice came out with their antitrust suit against them, taking it down. And remember, yesterday's session, when we were down big, shaved about $113 billion in market cap off of Apple in just one day. And Tyler, we'd like to give you some perspective. $113 billion is like shaving roughly the entire market cap of Boeing off of Apple's market cap in just one day alone. I'll send things back over.
Gives you a sense of scale there, Dom. Thanks very much. With the major averages on a weekly winning streak and Dow 40,000 on the horizon, should investors pop the bubbly or be worried about the market being too bubbly? One of my next guests says we will pull back. He also says we will see Dow 100,000. And he's been around for a few market milestones like this one. Dow 10K in March of 1990. Look at that youthful man there. He even put it on a baseball cap and he hasn't aged a day. For more, let's bring in CNBC contributor Michael Farr, president and CEO of Farr Miller in Washington, along with Michael Cugino, permanent portfolio family of funds president. A pair of Michaels today. Michael Farr, let me begin with you. You say that the market is bubbly, but not in a bubble. What's the distinction there?
A bubble is one of those runaway things, Tyler. And if you forget the names of the guests today, you're in real trouble with the two Michaels here. That's a test, Tyler. You know, so we've seen elevation. Have we really gotten to the point where we're seeing a bubble form in AI? Every time we've seen these bubbles, we've had a whole lot of leverage in the market. Kind of runs counter to the idea that there's $7 trillion in money market right now. So we're looking for leverage. Prices feel inflated, but they don't feel ridiculous. And everybody's not on the same side of the bullish boat. That's always another bad sign. So I think we're moving that way, but not there quite yet. Reason to be worried, but not overly so.
How do you see it, Michael Cugino? Not ridiculous, but fully priced. Where are you on that spectrum?
Yeah, not only do we have the same name, but we probably have a similar viewpoint. certainly stocks are elevated, but not unnecessarily so, given the macro story. The Fed is likely done. They just came out saying they're probably going to cut. Corporate earnings have held up. There's a lot of liquidity on the sidelines. People are working and spending. It's hard to see a negative. It's almost a perfect storm for equities to continue to bleed up right now. There are some headwinds out there, but the impact of those are being way overweighted by the positives at the moment.
So, Michael, you say that we'll probably pierce 40,000 at some point, probably have a correction at some point here, a pullback, and eventually motor forward up to 100,000. I want you to give me the date and time that we're going to be at 100,000.
I mean, it's in your inbox, Tyler. Okay. Just take a look for that. You know, when you take a look at where we are, this is math and the rule of 72 and compounding. So if the market doubles every 10 years, 15 years from now, we ought to be at 100,000. That's it. That's just the math. If we do 7.5% return on the Dow Jones Industrial Average. So I think, you know, 40,000 is on the way here. Clearly not, doesn't look like it's going to happen today. Next week would not be a surprise. It's not going to be that important in terms of the percentage change of your portfolio, but it's really important in that it is a great vindication and a great endorsement of the American economy, of capitalism in general, that this is the place that is the shining city on the hill where capital formation can happen, where property laws and contract laws are regarded and respected, and the American dream happens here. Every time we hit one of these levels, we all ought to put flags out in front of our houses and celebrate. This is why you watch CNBC. You understand that really the heart of America and our economy and economic growth is what keeps the American dream alive. CNBC covers it every day.
Michael Cugino, I remember, as probably you do, when the Dow was at 1,000, not anywhere near 40,000, and that sounded like hysteria. So are you on draw? What are you smoking crack here? What do you say in terms of how I ought to position my portfolio? Now, I know you're a big believer in diversification and diversifying beyond merely stocks and bonds.
Yeah, I mean, I also remember Dow 36,000 when we were somewhere in the teens. So we're definitely going to continue to trend up over the years, but who knows how long that takes. I think psychologically, it's a psychological factor too. And, you know, amen with what Michael's saying. Mm-hmm. But in terms of, you know, how you want to position a portfolio, there are other asset classes that people need to be considering in terms of a broader comprehensive definition of wealth. That would include bonds. It would include U.S. and non-U.S. securities, stocks and bonds. It would include commodities, real estate, mm-hmm. precious metals, et cetera. All of these things impact the economy at some level, and a properly diversified investor, even growth investors, need some offsets or some balance to a portfolio, at least for a portion of their capital. And so we would advocate, even if you feel very strongly about the stock market, there likely will be corrections or pullbacks. There could be a period where it doesn't do much, or be given your liquidity needs or age or whatever, you may need more balance, more diversification, less volatility, but still getting a return. And so we would advocate for mm-hmm. diversification as well.
Let me finish with you, Michael Farr, if I might. You say, and I think it's a telling and important point, that time and not timing is what generates wealth in the equity markets. I couldn't agree with you more. That's the lesson that you were just pointing to there. But timing does matter, doesn't it? At least at the margins, because when you buy and when you sell, if you sell, is what determines your ultimate return.
No question, Tyler. So having a discipline is really, really important. And remembering the other fundamental rule, which is buy low and sell high. When markets are making new all-time highs, you've got to be very careful about your buying, and you have to be even more careful about your owning. Complacency is the greatest risk now. We haven't really had a bear market in quite a while. We did have a blip at the beginning of COVID, but it was short-lived, and people haven't felt pain in a while. And people say, oh, the risk is fine. Oh, I can have more risk exposure. Oh, this is going to work out. I can hold through. You haven't seen your portfolio down 20% in a long time. Make sure that you're following your discipline and that you're trimming some of these equity positions that are getting too big, where risk is creeping into your portfolio. Don't be a victim of complacency. Be a devotee of that long-term goal that you set when you started to invest. You're going to get there. Stick with it. Don't be emotional.
All right. The two Michaels, thank you very much. Have a great weekend, gentlemen. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Tyler.
Thanks.
All right, you got it. All right, let's turn to another part of the market, and that's the Reddit IPO. Shares dipping below their opening price of $47, now back above it at $47.83, hovering a little shy of $48. The stock closed up 48% from its IPO price of $34 a share yesterday, climbing as high as 70% before blowing off a little steam. Kathy, was ARK Invest buying into the social media company, scooping up nearly 10,000 shares of Reddit on its first day of trading, but there are plenty of challenges in store. Julia Boorstin was on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange for yesterday's IPO, joins us now. What are the challenges ahead for Reddit? But number one is how to make money.
Well, yeah, so this company has yet to turn an annual profit. Last year, reported the loss of about $90 million. But Steve Huffman, the CEO of Reddit, told us that in the back half of the year, they did show profitability. And he's outlining a plan to use AI to make their ads better targeted, more efficient for their ad buyers, and also to license their data to the likes of Google to generate new licensing revenue to train the Google AI systems. So one big question here in terms of the challenges is what the FTC does. They're investigating Reddit's data licensing practices. Now, Reddit says this isn't a problem, but analysts are watching this as a key area because they need to make sure that they really can indeed continue to license this data in order to create this new revenue
stream. Is the path to profitability here really goes through the advertising business, right? I mean, it's an advertising driven company.
95% of their revenue now. 95% of the revenue is from advertising, and they're competing when it comes to advertising, not only with the likes of Snap and Pinterest, but also with Meta. And Meta is so much larger. Meta and Google are the digital duopoly here. We're seeing the rise of players like Amazon when it comes to digital advertising. Reddit has this challenge of competing with much larger players. What they say is that they have a very much unduplicated user base, meaning that advertisers can reach people on Reddit who they can't necessarily find on the likes of a Snap, Pinterest, or Facebook. So we'll see how that plays out. And then they also say that a lot of people come to Reddit with intent to buy. People might be asking questions on Reddit about what kind of car should I buy, what kind of electric toothbrush. And so it's a place to reach people when they're open to information about purchases. But that's going to be a key thing to watch here. And then as we watch revenue growth rates for all of these players, we're going to be very carefully watching their revenue growth rate for an indication of how much they're able to continue to convert advertisers.
Who are some of the biggest, I don't mean to catch you off guard with this, but who were some of the biggest shareholders that made money yesterday? I know that the founding family of Condé Nast, Advanced Publications, is one of them. Are there others that we would know?
Sam Altman.
Really?
Made quite a bit of money on Reddit. He was very briefly the CEO of the company. And so through that process, bought some shares. But Advancet, which is part of Condé Nast, has turned quite a profit because they originally invested just $10
million. $10 million and now $1.4 billion.
Yeah, so this is a good thing for them at a time when the traditional media industry is certainly a struggle.
Interesting story in the New York Times today about Reddit and how it transformed itself from the inside out, not by targeting individual Redditors or contributors, but by targeting subreddits, groups, and kicking them out to make it a less toxic place to hang out.
Yes, you really want to have positive information, positive content. You don't want to have anything toxic or inappropriate because that's very important for advertisers. Advertisers don't want to have their content near anything inappropriate. So what Reddit did is they really empowered their moderators. These are the unpaid people who are doing such important work on Reddit to pull out stuff that's false or that's offensive or that's hate speech. And so they really empowered them with more tools to make sure they're keeping the content on Reddit fair.
And I look forward to next week. You'll join me at
2 o'clock
all
week
long.
We'll be co-anchoring in the two together. I'm looking forward to it, Tyler.
Nice to see you, Julia. All right, Julia Boorstin there. Coming up, whether it's using AI and robots in stores or dragging workers back to the office, corporate America looking for ways to drive productivity. Up next, we will look at the latest trends and whether they are heading us toward a productivity boom or bust. And speaking of tech, Apple coming off its worst day since August after being targeted by the Department of Justice. We are going to look inside the regulation playbook for the mega caps and why Microsoft may have just put on a masterclass for avoiding Washington's eye. The Exchange is back after this.
This is The Exchange on CNBC.
From a flat tire in the city to a dead battery on a distant drive, AAA is partnering with T-Mobile for Business to accelerate response times and get more drivers back on the road fast. Our nationwide connectivity powers location telematics, so AAA's fleet can find stranded drivers quickly while being fully equipped with the in-vehicle tools to have answers when they get there. This is elevating the member experience. This is AAA with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones, from powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY, a big idea that inspired the world to invest differently, and still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Bullish sentiment, for the builder stocks this week. The ITB construction ETF is up more than 5% on the back of positive housing data. But our next guest is turning to a completely different name in a different sector for what he calls a potential stealth housing play. And that is the electronics retailer Best Buy, also having a good week, helped by another bullish call from J.P. Morgan today. Joining us now for more is Anthony Chukwumba, senior analyst for specialty hardlines retail at Loop Capital. What do you see in Best Buy, Anthony?
So really what it comes down to is that Best Buy is the largest television retail in the U.S. They have about a third domestic market share. They're also the third largest appliance retail in the U.S. behind Home Depot and Lowe's. I estimate between appliances and televisions, that probably accounts for about 25, maybe even 30% of their sales. And so if existing home sales in particular continue to pick up, I think that will be really good for their appliance business. I think it'll be really good for their television business. And like I said, I mean, a lot of companies that are more sort of direct plays on the housing market, like think an RH, a Williams Sonoma, even a Floor and Decor, they're trading at huge multiples right now. Best Buy, not so much. So that's why I identified Best Buy as a stealth housing market play.
It's an interesting pick, but and as you say, let's look at some of those other companies that are maybe more directly associated with housing, like an RH, like a Floor and Decor, Williams Sonoma, and so forth. Do you see the upswing in the housing market benefiting them or not as much because they have a higher price to begin with?
Right. So essentially that's my argument. It will certainly benefit them and quite frankly, probably much more directly than Best Buy, but that's already much more priced into those stocks. Just in the last few months, we actually downgraded both RH and Williams Sonoma from buys to hold ratings, largely based on valuation.
Yeah, interesting. What do you see for the housing market this year? I mean, the numbers in February were quite favorable compared with January. Interest rates presumably are going to come down later in the year. That should be a bit of a help for housing. But there's still a lot of issues with inventory.
So I'm incredibly bullish on the U.S. housing market right now. Part of that is the fact that you are coming off of a very, very easy comparison, particularly for existing home sales. But part of it is just based on the data we've seen, right? So we have had sequential improvements in existing home sales in the last 2 months. The 4.3 million units in February were the highest level since February of 2022. And this is all before mortgage rates really come down. So the 30-year fixed mortgage rate is still almost 7%. So we think that as the Fed starts to cut rates and mortgage rates come down in turn, that will lead to a significant acceleration in existing home sales, even from where we are right now. And to your point about inventories are slowly but surely getting better.
Well, that is good news. And you look at some of the fundamentals of the U.S. economy, they would favor housing. When you have wage growth coming in at plus 4% for many, many months, which has been the case, when you have things like jobless claims falling and the unemployment rate staying where it is. Housing is highly related to income and jobs, correct?
100%. You nailed it. You nailed it right on the head. You hit the nail right on the head. I mean, you have unemployment less than 4%. We've had now, I believe it's almost over two and a half years of at least 4% year-over-year wage growth. The last 10 months has been higher. The wage growth has been higher than the rate of inflation. So consumer purchasing power is actually getting better right now. So, I think there's a lot of tailwinds for better home sales in 2024.
All right, Anthony, thank you very much. Great to see you. Have a good weekend. Anthony Chukumba. Artificial intelligence and work from home are two of the biggest factors for companies looking to drive productivity from their employees. Today, we look at both and what kind of a boost they're giving America's workforce. Courtney Reagan, let's begin with you and see how retailers are using AI. Hi, Court.
Hi, Ty. Yeah, so automation, AI, other machine learning has really helped increase productivity for retailers in stores, which is often now also being tasked with fulfilling online orders. Tractor Supply has several AI tools, and they're designed to make their employees more efficient in stores, like its headset assistant, Hey Gura, which answers questions about products, inventory, and then helps employees with even their HR-related questions. And Badger Technology, Marty the robot. It works in grocery stores like Stop and Shop and hardware stores to scan inventories and alert employees of hazards and aisles.
It's a great kind of phone a friend that you can have. And I think, you know, as the team members start to use it and they become more confident in it and more reliant on it, you know, I think it creates a kind of a war for talent opportunity for us or a win for us. Because they might be hesitant to, you know, leave to go to another job where they don't have such a tool.
But they improve their accuracy over 90% by freeing up over 40 hours a month of what the pricing coordinators have to do to check their pricing.
Home Depot's Sidekick app, it prioritizes highest value tasks more efficiently for the store associates. It's improved productivity by increasing on-shelf availability, associate engagement, and customer service scores. Sam's Club uses Brain Corp's autonomous inventory scanning and floor scrubbing robot. And Walmart is expanding its use of drone delivery with partner like Wing for faster delivery of these smaller items. Now I'm going to send it over to Kay Rogers for a look at increasing productivity from remote workers.
Hey there, Court. Well, productivity really depends on what type of job you have and what type of self-discipline that you possess. But on the whole, a research paper from Stanford on the evolution of work from home actually found that working fully remote is associated with a 10% lower rate of productivity than fully in-person work. Hybrid work appears to have no impact on productivity, but it's popular, of course, because it improves recruitment and retention, according to Steve Davis, who's one of these Stanford researchers. Now, separate data from JobList found that younger workers are seeking in-office experiences these days at higher rates than other generations, at a rate of 57% versus about a third in all other generations. I spoke with two Gen Z workers earlier in their careers who say they actually prefer working in office for career growth opportunities, socialization, and of course, even productivity.
I think as someone who's pretty recently out of college, it's helped me transition into the workplace life more and just adulthood more, being with other adults.
I think being able to collaborate with your team is certainly a benefit of being able to go into the office. In my experience, collaboration was a lot more difficult when working remote. You know, you don't really have that in-person ability to really walk up to a desk and you know, ask the questions.
Now, as for the industries where people are most working from home these days, it's information, finance, insurance, and professional, and business services, not TV shows, guys.
What do we know, Kate, about the ultimate productivity of people who work from home? Are they more productive?
It's
are they less productive?
It's just a little bit around 10% lower if you're fully remote. Hybrid really has no bearing on productivity. It's kind of break even, but we do know it's great for attracting, recruiting, retaining people because people do enjoy that flexibility. And it can, if it's done properly, be a cost savings to some companies that they could reinvest back into the workforce.
Certainly helps people who might find it difficult to come into the office every day to actually hold a job and be productive.
Also, what's interesting is that the Stanford research team found that the people who are most likely to want to work from home and who are most working from home these days, millennials. Kids, because they want the flexibility.
Totally. So, Court, where does this AI revolution take us in terms of workers and the demand for workers?
So that's such a good question. And I asked the CEO of Badger Technologies, which is the one that runs these robots that do these inventory scans and also help for hazards in the aisle. And he says of the retailers that he's worked with, no one has laid off employees as a result of it. They've just shifted their tasks, especially because retail has gotten so much more complex. And workers are being asked, especially in stores, to do so much more. Help customers in person, but also maybe fulfill an online order. So if they can take away tedious tasks like writing down how many bottles of Tide are in any given aisle or cleaning up a bottle of Tide when it falls over, they can serve the customers more. And that sort of helped them also like their jobs more and retain people. Hal Lawton of Tractor Supply was talking about how their talent retention has really increased since they've introduced a lot of these AI tools to make their jobs easier and, frankly, take away the more tedious tasks.
We had an interesting conversation with Aaron Levy of Box the other day, and he had this hypothesis about how AI is going to affect the workplace headcount. And he said in the early stage, it may reduce it. Mm-hmm. But in the longer run, as AI increases productivity and companies make more profit, they make more money, they grow faster as a result of profitability, that will mean that they will invest back in their business and expand and ultimately probably hire more people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that is really fascinating. And I think a lot of times in retail, at least when we're talking about automation, a lot of the focus is in the warehouses or the distribution centers. And I think in those cases, some of that automation can replace workers. But I think what I focused on was the automation that's going on in stores. And that is really helping the workers. But I understand Aaron Levy's point.
I would also just add, too, in covering the restaurants, which is obviously another service sector type of a job. Same thing. Chipotle's been a great example of a company that's using the avocado, for example, that's prepping the avocado. So that's a repetitive task that's tough for workers. They don't necessarily enjoy that the way they would with, like, interfacing with consumers, for example. And it makes their job easier. So what does that do for, you know, attracting, retaining people down the line remains to be seen, but it's interesting, and they're testing it out, so we'll know
soon. Avocados, you can't really interact with an avocado.
I mean, you know, I try to talk to them. Yeah.
Kate's a plant lady, so she probably does. Yeah. She probably gets them to like grow and ripen faster.
They don't laugh at my jokes.
They don't have service problems.
They don't ripen faster when you talk to them.
No, no, unfortunately not. But we'll see.
Enjoyed having you here. Good to have you here this week, Kate. Nice to see you.
Court,
thanks. All righty, still ahead. Senator Warren calling on the SEC to investigate Tesla, its board of directors, and CEO Elon Musk over governance issues. We'll tell you what she's worried about and whether investors should be concerned. And obviously, Elon Musk doesn't seem to be with that big grin. And as we head to break, take a look at shares of Lululemon plunging after posting weaker than expected guidance as demand slows in North America. Shares having their worst day since the start of the pandemic, down 70 a share. The exchange is back after this.
Hi, I'm Ben. I suffer from a condition called writer's block. It strikes when I'm at work. That's why I choose Canva Magic Write. It works fast, generating texts in seconds, thanks to AI.
Common side effects include increased productivity, compliments from coworkers, feelings of satisfaction.
Now I can say bye-bye to writer's block.
Ask your boss if Canva Magic Write is right for you at canva.com, designed for work.
Welcome back to The Exchange. I'm Pippa Stevens with your CNBC News update. Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene filed a motion today to remove Mike Johnson as House Speaker. Greene said to reporters that the motion was, quote, more of a warning than a pink slip. It comes as the House passed a spending bill this morning to avoid a government shutdown. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel today, where he discussed options for Israel's ground operation in Rafah and reiterated the urgent need for aid in Gaza. As he departed Israel, Blinken said the offensive would jeopardize the country's standing and long-term security. It was the last stop of his sixth trip to the region since the start of the war between Israel and Hamas. And after yesterday's surprise defeat of number 3 Kentucky and several other high-seeded teams in March Madness, less than 1% of all brackets are still alive. But if you're Atlanta Falcons running back Bijan Robinson, the NCAA X account said his entry was one of only a few left with a chance of a perfect bracket. Tyler?
I'm going to jinx myself. I did pretty well yesterday.
I have
three brackets working. A couple are in the 70% area, and one is a little higher than that. So I'm feeling very proud of myself right now. Pippa, thank you. Coming up, can Apple take a page out of Big Tech's regulation playbook as it deals with the Justice Department's new antitrust suit? That one is next when we return on The Exchange. Welcome back, everybody. The Department of Justice massive news suit against Apple, just the latest regulatory battle facing big tech. There's also the FTC facing off with Amazon and Meta, and the DOJ against Alphabet. But one mega cap that seems to have dodged scrutiny so far is Microsoft. Not that they haven't been in the target hairs before. Deidre Bosa has that story in today's Tech Check. Hi, Dee.
Hey, and that is key that they have some experience here. But fast forward to today, two key pieces of the AI arms race, technology and talent, very interconnected too. And Microsoft is collecting on both fronts, all while dodging the regulators. And it turns out that that could be their edge. Just look at this week. Apple was hit by that giant antitrust lawsuit. Microsoft poached Inflection's top talent while seemingly appeasing its investors with a large licensing fee. As you mentioned, Google, Meta, Amazon, they're already under scrutiny by the DOJ or FTC. So why does Microsoft seem to be avoiding the regulators better today? Well, it may have something to do with that past experience. Microsoft President Brad Smith, he was there during the antitrust lawsuits of the late 90s and the early 2000s. So he has experience, and he may now be structuring current deals, like its $13 billion cumulative investment in OpenAI, in ways that sidestep the type of scrutiny that an all-out acquisition would potentially invite by the regulators. Now, Google wants Ruth Porat to play that role at the company, but nearly 8 months after announcing that she would become president and communicate more with Washington, they're still searching for her CFO replacement. That hasn't yet happened, but you touched at it at the top, Tyler. It is about that experience, and Microsoft is proving to be very adept at playing the regulators while accumulating all of this talent and technology from the AI darlings.
It's kind of interesting to me, Dee, that as I think back on the history of Microsoft's brush with antitrust, it was more than a brush. That understates it by about a factor of a million.
Yeah.
But it really had to do as much as anything with, correct me if I'm wrong here, sort of a similar thesis as to what the DOJ is bringing, or the antitrust regulators are bringing against Apple. In other words, the idea that Microsoft, way back when, was trying to create a closed ecosystem where everything was tied into Windows. You got Windows, then you got their browser, you got their email, and they were creating this walled garden, which is kind of what the antitrust regulators are accusing Apple of.
So, yes, the walled garden is a common theme. However, as many people will point out, especially here in San Francisco, the numbers are very, very different. Microsoft had a different kind of monopoly, a different kind of market share at that time than you could argue Apple does today. It has less than 60% of the smartphone market, I think about 58%. So Android is, you know, a reasonable competitor here. But it is about that ecosystem. You're right. Let's look at the implication, though, right? What happened when Microsoft was dealing with those lawsuits back in the late 90s, early 2000s? Essentially a lost decade. And that's the fear here, that whether or not this lawsuit is right or wrong, what happens is that it will amount to a distraction for Apple at this really important time when it's trying to convince investors, users, that it has an AI strategy and proposition. So where does that go? This is the most important platform shift. Does Apple risk falling further behind?
Yeah, very interesting. It's going to be interesting to see what happens with those suits. And certainly if there's a change in administrations in Washington, what happens with some of those antitrust suits?
Yeah, good point.
Anyhow, Dee, thank you very much. Have a great weekend. Shares of Tesla, meanwhile, under pressure after Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren once again asked the SEC to investigate the company, Elon Musk, and the company's board over governance issues. This as Tesla trims production in China as sales growth stalls. Here to discuss is Dan Levy, senior equity analyst at Barclays, along with our own Phil LeBeau. Why don't you start off, Phil? What do you make of Senator Warren's letter first to the SEC?
Not new arguments, similar to what we've heard from her in the past when it comes to Tesla, Elon Musk, and the governance of Tesla, the board of directors. She says there's a financial conflict of interest, there's a lack of oversight, a lack of disclosure, and as a result, shareholders are hurt because of that relationship. Not surprisingly, Elon Musk, and he's heard this before, he tweeted out today, you know, it seems like Senator Karen, and that's what he refers to Senator Warren as, Senator Karen is getting her cues on this complaint from SBF's dad, SBF being Sam Bankman-Fried. He has long said, look, Sam Bankman-Fried's father advised Senator Warren's staff in the past, and therefore she's taking her cues from him. So we've heard these concerns from Senator Warren in the past regarding Elon Musk. I'm not sure that the SEC is going to do something specifically because of this letter, but we have heard this from her in the past.
Yeah, no fan clearly of Elon Musk, and the no fanism is reciprocated. Dan Levy, let's turn to you and talk more about the business of Tesla right now. How's it going, and what are their plans to overcome this slowdown, which is not just in the U.S., but more globally in EV sales, in China, for example?
Hey, hi, Tyler. Thank you so much for having me.
Sure.
Look, we are in the midst of what we call, or what many have called, an EV winter. We're looking at EV sales that have certainly slowed. There is still growth, but it's certainly a reset on the growth expectations. And when you look at it regionally, China is still humming along. But in a place like Europe, we just revised our forecasts to basically flat year-over-year growth or slightly above that. And when you look at Tesla, Tesla is certainly at the prime. So they're going to be reporting 1Q deliveries the next week or in a week plus. And we think that you're going to see some of those impacts of the sort of EV winter. Slowdown in China, roll-off impact from the roll-off of subsidies in Europe. And this is certainly questioning the pace of growth for them going forward. We're looking for something in the 420 to 425 range. Some of the data points we heard out of China maybe imply maybe some downside to that that came out this morning.
So 420,000 to 425,000 units in that first quarter. The consensus is a little higher, 468,000. So a modest sort of cut there from Dan. Phil, why are electric vehicles losing their popularity?
Depends on the market. Look, they're still growing in terms of sales, Tyler.
But not
but
as fast.
What you have, let's talk about the United States. You've got two major headwinds going on right now. One of them is pricing. And yes, Tesla fans like to say, well, look, you can buy the Model 3, and with the government incentive, you can get it down in the $30,000 to $35,000 range. But the fact of the matter is, the average transaction price for Teslas and for all EVs is higher than that. And there's just not a lot of options across the board for the entire industry when it comes to EVs that are moderately priced. And then the other headwind that is out there here in the U.S. that really bothers a lot of people considering going electric is the lack of a public infrastructure when it comes to charging, a reliable one. Yes, you have the Tesla supercharging network, but separate from that, Tyler, you don't have enough chargers, and they frankly don't charge fast enough. I think a lot of people are increasingly saying, if I'm going to charge up a vehicle, I do not have hours on end to spend here. This idea of have a snack and wait for it to be charging, that's not going to fly with people when they're looking at buying an EV.
Boy, I really agree with you on that, Phil. I, as people may or may not know, I have an EV. I happen to have a Tesla in the interest of full disclosure. Their supercharging network is good. It is pretty fast. Mm-hmm. But other chargers are way less fast. And even the home charger that I use takes a couple of hours overnight. Dan Levy, how would you answer the question I just asked Phil? How do you explain the idea that while they are still growing, EVs are, that growth has slowed? Why is that? Has Phil nailed it?
I agree with Phil. I think that it is an affordability issue. Prices are on a like-for-like basis at a premium versus ICE. I think that what Phil's talking about, this issue with charging, this is part of a broader issue of transitioning from the early adopters to the early majority. And so you are seeing some questions on the use case. I think you see a very different story regionally. China EVs are dominating, so that was a clear source mm-hmm. of upside. You know, we've seen in the last few months as high as almost 40% EV penetration. But when you look at Europe last year, Europe was basically flattish on EV penetration. In the U.S., it's still roughly 10%. I'll just point out one other aspect here. Just remember, especially in the U.S., so much of the EV story is Tesla. Part of Tesla's issue is that it's a very concentrated lineup. There is five paint colors. There's really two yes. dominant models. And so there's only so much option. The other automakers that are putting out other models, the issue they have is they can't keep up with the cost. The cost is just too overbearing. And so when Tesla is cutting prices, the others can't cut prices. And this is why you have some challenges from the other automakers on EV uptake and EV penetration.
Fascinating stuff. We'll be talking about this one for another decade and a half, long after I'm out of here. Dan, thanks very much. Phil LeBeau, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All righty, folks, coming up, it was a big week for IPOs with Astera Labs and Reddit, and we could get another big name debut next week. That is next. Be right back. Oh, we got a news alert now on Apple, and Steve Kovac has it. Hi, Steve.
Hey there, Tyler. Yeah, we have a report here about another research and development project being cut at Apple. This is coming from a Bloomberg report published moments ago. Apple is cutting their Apple Watch display unit. So this is a unit that was researching how to make in-house displays for the Apple Watch instead of relying on suppliers like Samsung and others. We've seen Apple do this with multiple products, most notably the chips that they put in their Mac computers, ditching Intel to use their own chips, and also seen some failures here too. For example, trying to make their own modem instead of using Qualcomm's modems. And then, of course, just a couple weeks ago, the cancellation of the Apple Car project, which resulted in the cancellation of that project, and about 1,000 jobs were at risk for here. Here it sounds like there are going to be some layoffs, but it's a much smaller group than the car project was, but still you see Apple shares here still up slightly after falling about 4% yesterday on the antitrust case from the DOJ, Tyler.
All right, thank you very much, Steve Kovac. Appreciate that. Coming up, shopping on social media ramps up, drugstore skincare is all the rage, and Facebook's Pokey feature is back. A look at the hottest trends among teens and tweens and the companies that are capitalizing on them. That is next. Welcome back to The Exchange, everybody. The TikTok bill, now on its way to the Senate, has far-reaching implications for users, influencers, and brands, and even maybe for President Biden. But it would also impact sales, particularly for direct-to-consumer companies using TikTok's shop feature, which launched just last September. But eMarketer estimated there were more than 33 million social buyers on the app last year. If you think that's a lot, Facebook had nearly 66 million, while Instagram came in second with 43 million. And social shopping is only getting more popular, particularly among Gen Z. So could TikTok's pain translate into yet another gain for Facebook? Joining us now to discuss is Casey Lewis, author of the Gen Z Trends newsletter, After School. Casey, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Walk us through. I'm aware of Facebook Marketplace and of shopping on Instagram. Why are they working so well for Facebook?
Yeah, the marketplace has emerged as kind of Gen Z's Craigslist, which is very interesting to see. And I think it's two reasons. Gen Z is obsessed with value. They don't have a lot of money to spend. They want to get a deal. And two, they appreciate sustainability. They love secondhand. So Marketplace kind of fits neatly in there. And I think the UX is good.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. It's interesting. Certainly, I look at what teens and tweens do in my town, and a lot of them go shopping at thrift shops. A lot of them.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, they are obsessed with nostalgia, too. So yeah. They like old stuff. I really think it comes down to, look, the babysitting money only goes so far.
Yeah, no, that's exactly true. What has happened to Craigslist by contrast? Are they suffering? They're not suffering, I wouldn't think. But they've seen erosion?
I think they're going to suffer. I think unless they do something. And the thing is, I don't know if you've been on Craigslist lately, but the interface is exactly the same as it was 10, 15 years ago, which in a way has its own nostalgic appeal. So maybe Gen Z will discover Craigslist because they like old stuff. And maybe that extends to websites, too.
Let's move on to another trend that Gen Z are doing, and that is ditching standard linear television programs, strip series, in favor of streaming services, number one. Well, that tell me something I didn't know. I knew that. But the other thing is that they're using watching live content, stuff on Facebook, stuff on Instagram, stuff on TikTok, stuff on YouTube, and they're much more entertained by that than investing the time in longer programming.
Yeah, this Deloitte survey found that 60% of Gen Zers would prefer UGC, user-generated content, to anything on a streaming service or even going to the movies. Bad news for Netflix, bad news for AMC. And I think the thing about UGC is it's infinitely scalable. It's plentiful, and it's also cheap. Again, comes back to, like, Gen Z is broke.
All right, let's talk a little bit about cosmetics. And you say it is young people, really quite young people, who are driving the purchase of cosmetic, skincare, facial stuff at places like CVS, Walgreens, and others.
Yeah, it seems the sort of exception to the rule of young people being broke are tweens, Gen Alpha, who have their parents' pocketbooks. Because Gen Alpha driving 49% of drugstore skincare sales growth. Skincare. It's crazy. We're not talking lipstick here. We're talking like serums. I didn't even know what a serum was when I was 12.
Yeah, I don't know what a serum is either. Another report is that 30% of Gen Zers say that they would rather look great today with a tan, even if it means looking worse later in life. Let me tell you, having had multiple Mohs surgeries, you don't want to do that. Casey Lewis, thanks, my friend.
Thank you so much for having
me. Appreciate it. Yeah, all that teenage years spent on the beach in Ocean City, Maryland, not a good idea. That does it for The Exchange. Contessa's getting ready for Power Lunch. I'll walk on over, join her on the other side of this break. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.